are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, January 23rd, 2020. I'm Michael Brooks. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Paul Heidman, author of a new piece in The Jacobin, The Third Way is the Past, Socialism is the Future. What really represents the future of our politics? The death of the Third Way, but also its history in the 90s and how we actually reverse global far-right authoritarianism. And speaking of which, Bernie Sanders is surging, folks. WBUR poll shows Bernie with a 12-point lead in New Hampshire. 29 points to 17 points for Mayo Pete, 14 points for Joe Biden. Even as a new Newsweek poll shows Bernie Sanders with the largest head-to-head lead over Donald Trump of anybody in the Democratic field. In fact, most Democrats are leading Donald Trump, with a couple of big exceptions like the New York Times loved Amy Klobuchar. She's trailing Trump by 5 points. Polling indicates that Trump and Biden may come to regret convincing America that Bernie Sanders is honest and uncorruptible, and most other people will regret the fact that that's apparently what he is. Sanders wins the California wins into the endorsement of a major California union, upping his lead among union endorsers. Another day of the impeachment trial, as Democrats continue to assemble a convincing case, and Zoe Lofgren has to explain that keeping a document classified cannot just be to avoid embarrassment. What? Narrow majority of Americans now support removing Donald Trump from office. San Francisco DA Chase Bowden ends cash bail for all criminal cases in a significant victory for justice. Texas, thousands of kids are losing Medicaid coverage each month. Donald Trump opens the door for cuts in Medicare and Social Security because guess what? He's a Republican. And because he's also a Republican, the Trump administration moves to get rid of restrictions and controls on to protect streams and wetlands in a boon to developers, following the lead of Maryland's environment-destroying Republican governor. CIA psychologist defends torture before a Guantanamo court. And Chinese cities cancel New Year's celebrations in an effort to stop a virus outbreak. The UK Tory government and Parliament have voted against a measure protecting children, child refugees. Barbarism is global. And the Germany urges Bolivia's next leader to revive a lithium deal, which was in doubt before the coup that removed Evo Morales, one dead and seven injured in downtown Seattle after a shooting incident. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. So the polls are looking really good. We'll get to this later, but this poll that was just put out by WBUR, which is the basically Southern New England, Boston-based NPR regional station. This is significant. This is putting Bernie with a 12-point lead and Biden falling to third by a couple points behind Buttigieg. And then we have Warren at 13. We have Klobuchar at 6. We have Gabbard at 5. Yang at 5. Steyer at 2. Bloomberg at 1. And former two-term neighboring governor Deval Patrick at 1. And this is interesting because I would say here, not only is Bernie opening it up, but if Gabbard and Yang don't stay at 5%, and those votes go, and those voters vote, I'm assuming those would probably go to Bernie. If there's 1% or 2% of Warren voters that are committed to some type of actual sort of progressive agenda, and they see the tea leaves, they'll break for Bernie too. So this is very encouraging. And it comes on the heels of this argument that they're having about Social Security, which is incredibly important. Now, and Sam outlined this very well yesterday. For decades, Joe Biden has advocated for cutting Social Security and Medicare. He flirted with a balanced budget amendment as well. He has been somebody who has, along with building his political brand in the 1980s by assembling the prison industrial, being a major assembler of the prison industrial complex, an architect of the war on drugs and other class and racist prison and policing policies. He was somebody who really wanted to prove his bona fides by cutting social, by being a Democrat who was willing to immiserate American seniors and assault the legacy of the New Deal. And again, Obama and Biden put vicious cuts on the table, which the only reason they didn't go through was because Republicans, you know, didn't want a deal that was 75% on their terms. They wanted 100%. And, you know, ideally an apology for Obama being African-American, right? Like, this was the Republican Party that they were dealing with and obviously we're still dealing with. These are some Google search terms, which they've stayed steady. They spiked, what is this, January 18th?
Yeah, starting January 18th. Yeah. But the story stayed alive, Biden, Social Security. And what's also interesting, if you look at the sub-region trends, District Columbia is number one, obviously, then Vermont, Iowa, number three, Oregon, Delaware, then we go to the next page. Number six is New Hampshire. So
these are great. And look, I mean, it's great because, of course, I think heading into the last, you know, couple of weeks here, and Sanders and Biden arguing about Biden's history of advocating cuts to Social Security when Biden's strongest demo is older voters, great. Secondly, it matters. It's important policy. We need to not only not cut it, we need to expand it like Bernie Sanders advocates. And third, this is going to be a big problem in the general election, but maybe a little bit less of a problem than I had thought a couple of weeks ago or even a couple of days ago. And of course, another huge opportunity if we're wise enough to nominate Bernie Sanders. In 2016, Donald Trump had the sense to lie his ass off about Medicare and Social Security. We're not going to cut it. You can't cut it. Now, anybody who knew anything knew, of course, A, he's lying. And of course, Donald Trump is fundamentally untrustworthy on everything besides racism and personal enrichment. But also, Paul Ryan himself, Paul Ryan, who was the, you know, his whole purpose in public life was give money to rich people, immiserate middle class, poor and working people. And he said in 2016, don't worry about what this guy says on the campaign trail. We're going to have the same congressional agenda. And of course, they did with the massive wealth giveaway in 2017 to the rich, which Trump still brags about. And they have been trying. They tried to gut the achievements of Obamacare. And of course, Medicare and Social Security have steadily been on the chopping block, as well as, you know, vicious policies towards food stamps, which the Trump administration has also pushed. So this is an enemy of working people because Donald Trump is a Republican. And it seems now, and we'll listen to some of the, you know, the gibberish and nonsense mumbling here from Trump in this clip on CNBC. But the major takeaway of this is that Donald Trump now sounds a lot more like Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan, which is both more transparent, should be obvious to everybody, and it's a great electoral opportunity for someone with a clear record on Social Security. This is, can be a major political advantage. If you nominate Joe Biden, you're going to muddle it the hell up because Donald Trump will lie and lie and lie and lie and lie and lie. The press won't cover it properly, and Joe Biden's record's compromised. Now, Bernie Sanders, with a clear record on Social Security, and yes, I know they dug up some quote from the mid-90s where Bernie said the program might need some adjustments. Bernie Sanders is definitely almost 1,000% talking about lifting the cap on wealthy people getting taxed to fund Social Security.
More generous inflation adjustments.
Or generous inflation adjustments. He fought against chain CPI when Obama proposed it. He fought against every single deal to cut it and has been on record supporting expanding it. So please, let's not do the bullshit. This could be a good Bernie campaign ad.
I dare. One last question.
Go ahead.
Entitlements ever be on your plate?
At some point, they will be. We have tremendous growth. We're going to have tremendous growth. This next year, it'll be toward the end of the year. The growth is going to be incredible. And at the right time, we will take a look at that. You know, that's actually the easiest of all things, if you look, because it's such a big
percentage.
If you're
willing to do some of the things that you said you wouldn't do in the past, though, in terms of Medicare.
Well, we're going to look. We also have assets that we never had. I mean, we never had growth like this. We never had a consumer that was taking in through different means over $10,000 a family. We never had the kind of things that we have. Look, our country is the hottest in the world. We have the hottest economy in the world. We have the best unemployment numbers we've ever had. African-American, Asian-American, Hispanics are doing so incredibly, best they've ever done. Black, best they've ever done. African-American, the numbers are incredible. The poverty numbers, the unemployment, and the employment.
I don't know if does he think African-American and black are different things? Is he? I don't know. That's his stat. We don't need to hear the rest of it. I mean, obviously, he's just going to go on and ramble on. But this is a good preview of the general election. If you're Bernie Sanders, you can seize on that and run circles around him because absolutely, as it is always the case with Republicans, Social Security is on the chopping block. But Social Security could definitely also be on the chopping block with Joe Biden. And then the second part, when you start getting into a game about the economy, it's going to take somebody like Bernie Sanders to say, well, let's get real here. Skyrocketing inequality. Millions of Americans working multiple jobs just to survive. A new temp economy, which is downwardly mobile, low paying, healthcare, more and more out of reach for people. This is the real state of the economy. And by the way, this was the real state of the economy that you lied about doing something about in 2016. If you're, you know, Biden, again, it gets more tricky because what are you going to do? You're going to say, well, you know, look, yes, Obama did. He got us out of the recession and so on. But the bragging of the Obama record is more analogous to what Trump is bragging about, right? Which is that there is conventional economic growth. There has been for several years now. Now, of course, we could go into recession. We could have, you know, there could be major economic problems on the horizon. But you need somebody with the credibility to talk about the real state of the economy for most people in this country. And it ain't so rosy as most people know in their actual experience, regardless of the numbers. So I would love to, instead of running against 2016 economic con artist Donald Trump, let's run against Republican establishment Donald Trump. Let's run against Mitt Romney, except bloated and with weird skin and odd comments about his daughter. I'm into it. I'm ready for that race. Let's run it.
Why? You're getting nervous, man. Calm down. It's okay.
Shout out, Vic Berger.
Shout out, Vic Berger. Capping off the closing argument segment on the before as we. As we rocket towards Iowa and New Hampshire here. Valentine's Day is special, but it's only one day. Luckily, there's something that can help make it date night all throughout the year. I'm talking about Hunt a Killer, an activity that you can experience with a loved one every month. Roll up your sleeves and work together to solve a realistic murder mystery. Hunt a Killer thrusts you and your friends and family into an ongoing murder mystery investigation. The game brings people together by challenging them to decode ciphers, examining clues, and solve puzzles. It's like an escape room delivered right to your door. Hunt a Killer has 2,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot, and Fast Company named them as one of the most innovative entertainment companies of 2019. Plus, part of the proceeds of every box goes to the Cold Case Foundation. Sam raves about this on a daily basis. I haven't had an opportunity to play it yet, but I definitely plan to. Sam raves about it. He talks about how it's bringing him and particularly, you know, he's got a teenage daughter. She's out doing her life. She wants, you know, she doesn't necessarily want to hang out with Sam. But this game is so enticing and so fun and such a great activity that it's an awesome bonding exercise and they're having a great time. Literally, I mean, brings the guy like clear joy. Talks about it off air. It's awesome. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority and use promo code majority at checkout for 20% off of your first box. huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off to show support for our podcast. That's huntakiller.com/majority. We will be right back with Paul Hydman. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Joining us now is Paul Hydman. He's a PhD candidate in sociology at the New York University, and he's also the author of The Third Way is the Past, Socialism is the Future, a new column for Jacobin Magazine. Read it online. Check out the link on the homepage. Paul, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. So, Paul, I guess for those of us who are not 90s kids, define the third way for us.
So the Third Way was a political project that really began to cohere in the 1980s, most notably in the United States and in the United Kingdom. And I think it's important to be clear that the Third Way is a kind of centrism, a certain centrist political project, but all centrists are not the Third Way. So in the piece, the piece was kind of charting the rise and fall of a very specific centrist political project in the 1980s that really came to hegemony in the 1990s in those two countries, in the U.S. and the U.K. And in both countries, the Third Way was a project of centrists in the Democratic Party and the Labor Party that saw the kind of their task of modernizing those parties. Both parties were thought to be kind of clinging to past dogmas about the welfare state, things like that, about, you know, regulation. And the partisans of the Third Way argued that this was not appropriate for a world undergoing globalization, things like that. They're really obsessed with a kind of Thomas Friedman-esque vision of this kind of exploding globalization, modernization, changing everything. We have to rethink everything, all of that kind of stuff.
So, and this is the, again, I mean, the most prominent leaders representing this would be Bill Clinton and Tony Blair. But just to be clear, I mean, would you say, if we wanted to broaden it out, and I know that it isn't just the center, it is a particular project, but would it be fair to say, obviously the other prominent leaders in the 90s that would kind of fit would be everybody from, you know, Thabo Mbeki, Gerhard Schroeder, Enrique Cardozo, maybe Massimo D'Alema. But then moving forward, even though they use a very different rhetoric, would it be fair to kind of also slot Justin Trudeau, Macron, Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton in this as well?
So yeah, that's a staggering array of political history right there.
Yes.
I think I would tend to kind of limit the Third Way to the attempt to chart out a new path for parties that had, you know, some kind of attachment to social democracy. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, I mean, obviously in the U.S. with the Democrats, that's a complicated question. But both, if you take the U.K. and the U.S. as kind of paradigmatic examples, the rise of, like, third-wave politics was all about our parties used to be about this. Now they need to be about something different. Now they need to be about opening up markets. They need to be about modernizing. They need to be about competition, right? Like, these need to be the watchwords of our parties. And so I think someone like Schroeder in Germany, you know, that can definitely apply to. But I'm a little more hesitant, especially for someone like Macron, who, you know, is kind of this sui generis figure that is pretty plainly not going to leave any kind of institution behind when he is finally kicked out of office, you know? And so I think it's most helpful to see the third way as an attempt to reorient these political parties away from any kind of attachment to the labor movement, to institutions of the welfare state, things like that. And in the U.S. and U.K. example, it was also attached to a quite muscular foreign policy as well.
Right. So, yeah, can you, just to really nail this down, can you give a few examples, you know, maybe one each, you know, either from the U.K. Yeah. and the U.S. that kind of, but just are emblematic of domestic and foreign policy in the third way?
Yeah. So in the United States, the third way is really institutionalized in the Democratic Leadership Council, which is built in, is kind of formed in the 1980s as a conscious attempt to move the Democratic Party to the right. After the Reagan's success, Nixon's success and Reagan's success, electoral successes in particular, there were a whole series of kind of commissions in the Democratic Party attempting to move it to the right. And the DLC was formed in the 80s. Really kind of oriented on a generation of kind of conservative Southern Democratic governors, Bill Clinton, of course, being the most important. And he would go on to be chair or president of the DLC in the early 90s, shortly before being elected president. And for Clinton, the kind of key policy is probably welfare reform, right? So before Clinton, welfare was a categorical grant program, which meant the federal government gave money to the states and said, this is how you have to spend it, right? You have to spend it on money for on welfare expenditure, right? Clinton's welfare bill in 1996 changed welfare to a block grant, which meant that the federal government is now giving money to the states for purposes of poverty reduction, but it's saying, you know, you have wide latitude over how to spend it. So actually huge amounts of what's welfare spending now is spent on things like conservative marriage promotion policies, you know, things like that, right? Because the states say, oh, well, if we can get people to get married, you know, that'll reduce poverty. And so they're allowed, you know, they're not just giving money to poor people anymore. They're spending it on these kind of boondoggle programs, and punitive workfare measures, things like that. And all of this was in the name of, like, modernizing, right? We need, like, the old welfare system is attached to a kind of an old economy that doesn't exist anymore. For the new economy, we need this new, lean, innovative welfare system, right? That was the ideology of the third way in the United States. In the UK, I think the Iraq War is kind of the key moment of Tony Blair's premiership. And in the UK, it's important to see that in the context of, like, the Labour Party's evolution. So in the early 1980s, the Labour Party's leadership was for unilateral nuclear denuclearization, which were leaving NATO, right? Like a very left-wing foreign policy, which, by the way, was not, like, at all unusual among kind of left-of-center parties outside of the United States. Like, even the Liberal Party in Canada that Trudeau is now part of was very suspicious of NATO. Mm-hmm. And so, but this kind of, this political heritage in the Labour Party was totally jettisoned by Blair, who, over the course of his premiership, sought to attach the British state kind of more and more firmly to the United States in this Atlanticist partnership, which, you know, started in the wars in Yugoslavia, in particular with collaboration in the wars in Yugoslavia. And then when the Blair government emerged as the most important junior partner to the United States invasion of Iraq in 2003, it was an attempt to both kind of reassert Britain's imperial role in the world, right? Ever since the British Empire had, you know, decisively fallen apart in the 1960s, there'd been this kind of post-imperial malaise in the UK, and this kind of new muscular internationalism was an attempt to beat that back. An assertion that, like, that Britain was not going to be an enemy, right, or a rival of the U.S. on the world stage, but was going to be totally linked to the United States' broader global political project of, you know, a certain vision of capitalist globalization and all of that.
So you bring this into conversation with, and some of this will be new to people, some of this probably, I mean, certainly the general outlines of this aren't, just the idea, if you wanted to really simplify it, of social democratic parties moving to the right. But it wasn't as simple as that, mm-hmm. because there was this... For, you know, first of all, what's the relationship between the genuine ideological convictions of obviously right-wing politicians in an objective sense, like Tony Blair or Bill Clinton, marketeer politicians versus other politicians caught in this who may have not had the same, may have been more along the lines of, well, we don't really want to do this, but this is the only thing that's possible in the 80s and 90s, mm-hmm. which is a much more justifiable view than some people might realize, not that we would agree with it. And then this idea, and you mentioned Thomas Friedman, and as embarrassing it is, he would be the patron saint of these people. The mm-hmm. emphasis on innovation, on being with what's new, and on radical change, and this and all of this type of thing. And in a weird way, and you make this connection, that is sort of oddly the most Marxist part of it in a very bastardized and dumbed down sense. And we can go this into, you know, the management training mm-hmm. manuals of this time where, you know, like mm-hmm. some silly management guru who's, you know, advising companies on downsizing or, you know, tacky branding campaigns. You know, if you look at those books from like the late 90s, early aughts, like definitely let's throw in a Mao quote, you know, that'll really show yeah. like where we're at. And certainly in the UK where there was more of an actual left, some of the most kind of ardent Blairites had, you know, Trotskyite roots in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And they sort of brought along with them this certain understanding, which you do, you know, you say is found in Marx and then Lenin of that Marxism is about a future, no nostalgia for the past, no ideas, mm-hmm. you know, taken from pre-modernity. It's about, you know, hyper-modernization, but for justice instead of for capitalism. So is there a through line there in terms of a certain way of looking at Marxism and how third wave discourse developed?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think so. And like you say, I think it's particularly strong in the case of the UK, where in the 1980s, the magazine Marxism Today, which was associated with the Communist Party, was one of the kind of leading apostles of new times, right? That capitalism was changing and that the old politics of labor weren't going to be sufficient. And people from that milieu definitely ended up around Blairism. And yeah, you know, you read some of this stuff and it sounds like the first dozen or so pages of the Communist Manifesto, all that is solid melts into air, right? All that is holy is profaned. All the traditional relationships between people are upended. You read these kind of like you read Thomas Friedman. It sounds kind of like that. And so there was a sense in which they were able to draw on what I think had historically been one of the strengths of the left, right? The historic kind of appeal of the left was, the bourgeoisie led its revolution and they gave us capitalism. And now it's time for the workers to lead our revolution. We're going to have socialism, right? We're the next step in history. And of course, the course of the 20th century didn't leave a lot of confidence in that particular vision of history of socialism as kind of the logical next step. And in some ways, I think the third way was cashing in on that lack of confidence of the left, in the 1980s and 1990s in particular. But at the same time, as I say in the piece, when you kind of really dig into their vision of ceaseless change, it ends up being a vision in which nothing is really ever going to change, right? So this is when Francis Fukuyama writes The End of History, right? An essay about how a liberal capitalist democracy is the kind of final resting place of history, right? Like this is the final form of human society. And so it was the idea was kind of like there there's a world of ceaseless change, but in which nothing fundamental is going to change, right? All the change is ultimately surface level. It's everyone getting cell phones, right? Everyone getting cell phones, massive world historical change. But the social relations that make up our society, the forms of hierarchy, the way we organize our society, all of that is going to stay the same forever now, right? And I think that was ultimately a real weakness of the third way, and one reason for its failure.
And so explain that failure and then the kind of way in which, ironically, socialism reemerges, and even just as personified by a Bernie Sanders, right, is some sense of like, no, actually, maybe, and maybe even, you know, and this is maybe where Marx and Lenin were missing the point too. We actually do need to retrieve something that's older. And has been like a lost tradition that's worth rediscovering. Put those two things into relationship.
Yeah, I just love the kind of befuddlement with which the pundits like treat the appeal of Bernie to young voters under 35 or so. They just can't wrap their heads around it. It drives them crazy. Why are they voting for this guy in his late 70s? It doesn't make any sense. But you know, when you see what Bernie's saying, it actually makes perfect sense. And Bernie's appeal flows, I think, directly from the foundering of the third way. And if you look at the 1990s, if you look in the late 1990s, the third way seems like a juggernaut, right? Like Tony Blair is the prime minister of the UK and is moving forward with all kinds of plans. Clinton is in the US with very high approval ratings, has, you know, pushed through welfare reform. The economy is booming. It really seems like the third way prescription was right, that these politics are kind of in sync with the times. But over the next decade and a half or so, things change. And in the UK, it's really the Iraq War that undoes the project. It unleashes just such a massive scale of opposition inside the UK that it completely shatters the Blairite political project, so that the Labour Party's popularity is driven way down. And while Blair and then his successor, Gordon Brown, are able to kind of limp through until 2010, what's really notable is that since then, the Blairites have really been unable to constitute a kind of coherent hegemonic force in the Labour Party. You know, you had Ed Miliband as a leader who was a representative of the soft left, not the Blairite tradition, right? The Blairite tradition is further to the right. And you know, just I think in the last week or so, Jess Phillips, who is kind of the most prominent defender of that tradition in the party today, announced she was stepping down from contending for leadership. So there's been a real exhaustion in the Labour Party.
And Rebecca Long Bailey obviously is the person in our corner in terms of kind of continuing the defense of really trying to fight for a socialist position. But Keir Starmer, who's sort of, you know, the candidate of the center, he's Blairiting the Blairites. He's coming out and he's saying, you know, we need a party that embraces Jeremy Corbyn and Tony Blair, which is, of course, it's questionable, but it's certainly a rebuke to Blair, because Blair's out saying we need to uproot everything to do with Corbyn, root and branch.
Yeah, totally. They're just completely unable to kind of seize the high ground in the debates.
Right.
I'm sure they'll end up backing Starmer, but he is not of them, right? In the sense that that Phillips was.
Right.
So in the UK, the Iraq War is really what kind of leads to the end of the third way as a hegemonic force in the Labour Party. In the United States, it's not nearly so dramatic, partially because the Iraq War is carried out by the Republicans, right? I mean, if the disaster of the Iraq War had been on the Democrats' neck, it's very possible it would have come earlier in the United States, but it wasn't. It was on Bush. And so the Democrats were able to come in 2006 in the congressional elections, and then in 2008, the presidential elections, as the party of the rebuke of the Iraq War. And then, you know, in particular, they got lucky with the timing in 2008, where they were able to come in as the party that's going to clean up the financial crisis. And yet it was that very, the very way that cleaning up was conducted that I think led to the kind of slow disillusionment. And I think it is fair to call Obama a politician of the third way in this sense, right? I think that, you know, even as he was running against Hillary Clinton in 2008, the fact that the leadership contest in 2008 was between Clinton and Obama is really a testament to just how thoroughly Bill Clinton's kind of DLC vision of the party had won. Right. That the entire debate was between two politicians who hewed very, very closely to the third way line. And so as the recovery kind of proceeded, and we just had this incredibly unequal recovery, you know, the scale of losses to homeowners, number of people who lost their homes, and the kind of slow ticking up of deaths of despair, right? All of this, I think, was slowly hollowing out the edifice of third way politics inside the Democratic Party. And so, you know, you had the slow collapse of the Democratic Party in so many states under Obama, right? The persistent loss of the party on the state level. And all of this meant that when 2016 came around, the party as an institution was totally blindsided by Trump and unable to respond in any kind of effective way, right? And then Sanders' run exposed just how big of an audience there was inside the Democratic Party for a fundamentally different political position, a different political orientation. And so in the UK, the Iraq Wars was kind of detonation of Blairism. In the U.S., the Obama presidency was kind of a slow hollowing out of third way politics that I think, you know, to this day, we're seeing very little capacity for third way type politicians to organize on their own terms. They're actually being forced to tail Sanders at this point.
Right. And as you point out, I mean, whether or not I understand the more kind of precision way of defining third way, but I do think there's, you know, there is a much more elastic way of defining it as this sort of like, I mean, frankly, especially at this point, as it's really come to a complete intellectual standstill, as just sort of, you know, socially moderate market politics, essentially, right? And that's why you said, yeah. I mean, Biden is the carrier of that tradition right now. And he's running basically entirely on, you know, things were, you know, better under Obama. Let's just get to that. So in contrast to, you know, if you ask me what my agenda is, it's change, change, change. It's, you know, it's just, you know, you ask me what my agenda is, it's, you know, Obama, not Trump, Obama, not Trump. There isn't this new, like, and, you know, it's actually funny because you know, I don't want to say he's like Don Quixote because Tony Blair is, you know, making an obscene amount of money in private equity and advising dictatorships. Right. And, you know, actually, I just saw a new project. He's going to be the Saudis or the Emiratis, the head of SoftBank, the guy who helped propel WeWork, and Tony Blair have been contracted by the Indonesian government to help them design their new capital. That was the dystopian story of the week. All that being said, Tony Blair, when he intervenes in British politics, there is this very Don Quixote feeling about him because he still has the, you know, he obviously looks a lot more tired and everything, but he still has the presentation. He still has the style. He still has the communicative capacity, and he's just saying exactly, I mean, and, you know, now he's reacting against Corbyn, but his basic, you know, we need to be innovative, we need to be change oriented. And you're like, whoa, what? Like, I don't even know what you're talking about, right? Like, you know, we all at least knew generally what this meant in the 90s. And now it's just, you know, purely at the level of cliche. That being said, before we wrap it up, I mean, Corbyn is this dent in the narrative. And I think, of course, we have to acknowledge Brexit. We have to acknowledge an unprecedented and vicious propaganda campaign against him, which I have no doubt would also, if we really got into it, implicate different intelligence services. And I mean, and has a lot of stories to say about media monopolies. And by the way, these raw material things are also something that we in the left have to consider. There is an enormous amount of obviously power, wealth, and ideological hegemony amongst the ruling classes globally. So these are big challenges. I mean, that's probably the main story about Corbyn. But it's still, whether, you know, even with all of those caveats, it's a failure of our model. So what's the, how does this affect our narrative about this sort of resurgence of socialism, especially when somebody with such clarity and integrity could be torn apart by, you know, a buffoon like Boris Johnson?
Yeah, I mean, I think it means that their fall isn't necessarily our rise.
Right.
You know, that the end of the third way doesn't mean an automatic victory for socialism. It might, you know, it might mean like muddling around until some new Tony Blair comes around with a couple different buzzwords that'll sound new for a while. You know, there's nothing inevitable about socialist rise, and we should never mistake the weakness of our enemies for our strength. And I think the Corbyn loss was, you know, a devastating reminder of that. And I think it, you know, I think it's also a testament to the way that third way politics in particular hollowed out the Labor Party. Yeah. You know, that the Labor Party as an institution had become totally disconnected from traditional labor voters in huge parts of the country. And the Corbyn was able to bring, you know, an influx in particular of like urban youth, basically, you know, often educated urban youth into the party who came in massive numbers, but were unable to make up for that hollowing out. And in that sense, and I think that's something that we're probably going to face in the Democratic Party too. You know, if Bernie manages to win the primaries, all of a sudden the weakness of the Democrats in many states suddenly becomes one of the less number one problems. You know, that suddenly becomes our problem that we have to fix.
Maybe conversely, another reason why, I mean, it's not going to make up for organization, but thank you, Hillary Clinton. Because, I mean, you know, in a general election, to have the Democratic standard bearer be someone Hillary Clinton hates will be incredibly helpful in pivotal places that need to mobilize people. That will be a big trust builder for him in a place like Wisconsin.
Yeah. You wonder if her and Blair are like comparing notes behind the scenes of like, well, I think this is going to be really successful. So I'm going to go say that, like, you know, they managed to both hit the wrong notes just so persistently that it's a pretty impressive level of coordination.
And you say, just as a final note, you say old-fashioned socialism, it turns out, is the good old thing best suited for combating the bad new things of modern capitalism. So make that case in the last minute here.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're seeing a world in which the problems of modern capitalism have been dramatized as never before. And I think also in the United States right now, we saw this with Corbyn to an extent, but I think we're seeing it even more right now. The power of a basic socialist vision of the working class needs to stand together against the people at the top of society. You know, every day just reading about Sanders, listening to podcasts about Sanders supporters, things like that, you're seeing the way that very basic old socialist vision can animate people and provide a sense of purpose that is really lacking elsewhere in politics right now. And I think that's a very powerful thing and a very exciting thing.
Paul Heidman, the piece is The Third Way is the Past, Socialism is the Future. Read it in Jacobin, link on the show website. Paul, really appreciate your time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Michael.
Thank you. All right, folks, let me just say this first. Today's show is brought to you in part by Hunt a Killer, an activity that allows you to work as a team and investigate crime in the comfort of your home. It's the badass murder investigation where you decode ciphers, examine clues, and solve puzzles. Go to huntakiller.com/majority. Use promo code majority at the checkout for 20% off your first box. That's huntakiller.com/majority, promo code majority. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how this whole thing happens. If you haven't already, click subscribe and the bell button on YouTube and check out justcoffee.coop, sorry, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. Buy yourself the Majority Report blend. It's a win for everyone. Workers, ecology, the co-op economy, the Majority Report, independent, unbossed media. go over to the Michael Brooks Show YouTube page. Incredibly proud that the first half of our interview with former President Lula da Silva is up, former Brazilian president, political prisoner. Some great new information on negotiations with Iran, but a crash course in Southern solidarity, U.S. imperialism. It's, you know, obviously I'm really proud of it. If you haven't yet, go over there and watch it. And while you're over there, click subscribe and the bell button on the Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. We're at well over 100,000 subs now and continue to grow. We're very excited about it. And we're excited to see you at the Bell House February 7th with Ilona Minkowski, Matt Binder, Brandon Sutton, Harvey Kay, and Ben Burgess. It's going to be really, really fun. Go buy your tickets, and you can get all information for all things TMBS at tmbs.fm. And, of course, the best thing to do, and another, you will find out, you get early ticket sales April 3rd. We're doing a live show in Austin, Texas with Anna Kasparian, and Patreon members got the early bird discount. So patreon.com/TMBS. See you soon. Matt.
Yeah, folks, check out the Literary Hangover YouTube page as well. Right now, it's basically the waveform of the podcast, so it's another way to listen to the podcast. But going to be expanding into some historical documentary stuff with my partner, Alex. So you want to get on the ground floor of that, so go over and subscribe to Literary Hangover YouTube channel.
Sweet. See you guys in the fun half.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.